Okay, I'd like to begin by saying that I certainly have no objection to this presentation being recorded, but I wish to reserve the rights to publication. The presentation will be in two parts. First will be an address, and the next part, which will come at the end, will be some slides. And if there is any time, I realize that that is a problem and has been a problem, but if there is any time, I might entertain a few questions. Chicago, hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and the nation's freight handler. Stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. Fierce as a dog with tongue lapping for action. Cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness. Bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding. Laughing the stormy, husky, brawling laughter of youth. Half naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and freight handler to the nation. Chicago. These passages from Carl Sandburg's familiar poem offer an apt and artful portrait of the Middle Western industrial citadel around the beginning of this century. There was a great force of life there, exploding with the sense that this grimy giant astride the great green fields could thrust his fingers into millions of lives, touch the tables at which the people ate, touch the machinery of their labors, touch the way they traveled, and even touch the ears with which they listened. It was in this vital atmosphere of individuality, which rivaled the long-established industrial centers of the East, that certain plucky little firms arose, whose aim it was to sell, and in other ways distribute, talking machines of a very unusual nature. It is fair to begin with the most commonly recognized of these organizations, the Standard Talking Machine Company. Yet, we cannot properly commence our discussion with talking machines. Instead, we must start with as unlikely an article as Chinaware. It was on October 11th, 1901, that the corporation was begun, which would long go under the name of, before finally legally becoming, the Standard Talking Machine Company. Organized to manufacture, buy, sell, and deal in China in porcelainware and other articles of merchandise, this firm was originally called the East Liverpool China Company. Though this title seems to hint at a pretense and exaggerated effort at dignity, there was really a very good reason for its choice. It derived, in fact, from a place called East Liverpool in the state of Ohio. This importantly named city was not terribly exciting, but that was not the motive of the choice. East Liverpool was then, and was long to remain, one of the foremost centers in the nation for the manufacture of pottery, especially that used as premiums. A man named Robert Johns, who was very active in that city as a schemer and promoter of sales incentive devices, is no doubt related to the person who was to become president of the East Liverpool China Company of Chicago in 1907, Thomas E. Johns. Given what we know of the character of Robert Johns, these may even be two names for the very same person. It must be remembered that pottery was often used at the time as a gimmick to stimulate sales. In fact, one need only go into the local supermarket nowadays to see dinnerware being used in the very same way. Yet it occurred to these old hands at premium promotions at the East Liverpool China Company that there may be another article ready-made for such hoopla. an item which had the special appeal of being up to the minute, and for which there was a steadily growing demand. This was, namely, the talking machine. What an ideal enticement that would be. A cheaply manufactured machine could practically be given away because the merchant would be assured of the continued profitable sale of the records to fuel it. Yet, how, might ask the skeptical shopkeeper, was he to be sure that the new owner of the talking machine would not go somewhere else to purchase the records? The East Liverpool China Company had the answer, a variation of which was used by all the Chicago firms to be here treated. They equipped their machines in such a way as to demand the use of special records. So it was in this way that around 1905, the East Liverpool China Company began to include disc talking machines in its list of wares under the pseudonym of the Standard Talking Machine Company. These instruments were sold with an enlarged turntable spindle of approximately 1/2 inch in diameter. Hence, only standard discs having a correspondingly swollen center hole could be played. They issued 7-inch single-sided and 10-inch single and double-sided records. All seemed to have been pressed from regular Columbia Phonograph Company matrices, except for the size of the hole, or converted from old stock. This last technique, accomplished by pasting a standard label over an existing Columbia one and boring out the hole, was fairly common. So frequently was it employed, in fact, that it becomes apparent that Columbia was using smaller firms like Standard to dump its aging inventory. Standard machines were often sold with out-of-date records, though we may guess that the effect of this was not nearly so bad in the rural Midwest as it would have been in more sophisticated areas of the country. Columbia was a pervasive influence in the affairs of most of the little Chicago firms. This will be very apparent when we reach the slide section of this presentation. It is a curious and ironic note that later, in the 20s, Columbia was to disavow any connection with the Standard Talking Machine Company. It is assumed that this was either an especially blue-nosed bit of elitism, or, to be more sympathetic, a simple compliance with the letter of the contract which the two companies must have had. In 1907, the East Liverpool China Company underwent some changes, not the least of which was the alteration of its name to the Great Northern Manufacturing Company. This nomenclature is most commonly associated with Harmony disc talking machines, since it appears on the machines and records. However, it must be remembered that this title was really the official name of the parent corporation, which was still doing business in standard instruments. It was, in fact, at this point that the Harmony talking machine was introduced. Probably the talking machine business had become so lucrative that the management decided to decrease its involvement with pottery ware, which had been explicitly suggested by its original name. The new Harmony machines followed the pattern established by Standard of having an enlarged spindle orientation, this time of approximately 3/4 inch. Here we find records produced from ordinary Columbia matrices, but also some from the Star series, which were sold in the East by Hawthorne and Schiebel. In time, Columbia was drawn upon exclusively, and we recognize the same smattering of pasted over records as with Standard. All were 10-inch single or double-sided. No 7-inch discs appear to have been issued. Up until 1911, Standard was based at 198 to 202 Monroe Street, and the parent company, Great Northern, was operating at 147 to 153 Fifth Avenue. In 1911, however, a move was made to consolidate the parts of the company at one address. It is curious to note that at this time, Chicago itself was in the throes of a great transformation. Ever since 1909, the city had been undergoing a massive street renumbering, which involved changing the designation of practically every building in the city. By 1911, this confusion was at its height, and the disruption caused by it must have been considerable. For this reason, our talking machine companies, when they moved to the same building, wisely chose to identify their location as corner of Dearborn and Harrison Streets, rather than by the official address. This bit of expediency may be viewed on standard machines and records produced after 1911. It was also at this important juncture that an entirely new arm of the corporation appeared, with offices, of course, in the very same building. This was the United Talking Machine Company. Its name belying the circumstances of its birth, this firm traded in Symphony Machines and United Discs, which had a formidable spindle setup of 1.5 inches in diameter. This was a precipitous moment for the industry. America was about to embark on a decade of complete domination of the talking machine by Victor and Columbia. United lasted only a few years. In 1913, it and the Harmony division of the parent corporation were likely jettisoned when there was a major change in management. It was at this point that the parent firm finally came officially to be called the Standard Talking Machine Company. Up until then, the term had been nothing more than a DBA. United records were pressed from 10-inch double-sided Columbia masters. Once again, one often finds converted labels, as well as those to which the United label was applied at pressing. What became of the Standard Talking Machine Company after it changed hands in 1913? This is a question for which only an unsatisfyingly vague answer can be offered. Clearly, they continued to exploit the market they had already created, and probably to seek new avenues through department store promotions and direct advertising. What is quite extraordinary is that they endured for a length of time seemingly unwarranted by the circumstances, not only as a promotional device, but as a clever bit of machinery with an insatiable appetite for new records. To speak of this second group is really to tell the story of Arthur J. O'Neill. In all likelihood, he was the very embodiment of the companies in which he had a part. It was through his dogged involvement with free enterprise that they were sustained. It was through his research and experimentation that they were improved. Who was this man, this shadow, this forgotten entity who has gone to his dust short shrifted? He was an entrepreneur, a traveling salesman, a self-styled advertising specialist who fell in with talking machines, though he was most used to dealing in other items, from China to vacuum cleaners. Born in Wisconsin to Irish immigrant parents, he followed the path of so many first-generation Americans who passionately grasped at the opportunities offered by the new land. Despite a weakness of the lungs, which became chronic bronchial asthma, O'Neill pursued a vigorous business career. He married and fathered a large family. His sons would later assist him in the last of his enterprises. Throughout the first decade of the century, and for a few years thereafter, he was completely absorbed by the talking machine and the companies which I shall soon describe. In 1916, he was barely 48 years old and on the verge of an entirely new talking machine venture, importing Pathé phonographs. It was that fall when the weather turned cold and the famous Chicago wind began to charge through the streets that Arthur J. O'Neill began to complain of a pain in his chest. His nagging cough grew alarming, and finally he took to his bed. This measure, however, did not have the desired effect. His condition quickly worsened. There hardly seemed time to act. On the 4th of October, Dr. Wood was called. Down at the State Street Pathephone Company, the windows were dark. There was still so much to be done, but for Arthur J. O'Neill, life was over. In the cold stillness of that night, his breathing became heavy. And before another day could dawn, he was dead, a victim of pleurisy. Yet this man has left to us a great legacy of his deeds in the talking machines and records which were his principal works. These bequests begin with the outpourings of the O'Neill James Company. On April 22nd, 1904, O'Neill formed an association with Winifred B. James and Sherwin N. Bisbee to create the O'Neill James Company, Incorporated. Though this firm was initially involved with china and glassware in a like fashion to the East Liverpool China Company, within 2 years of its incorporation, it was listing talking machines as its principal trade. In a curious and cunning play on words, the treasurer of this firm, Mr. Bisbee, lent his name to the new line of machines and records, Busy Bee. Both cylinders and discs were distributed under this brand. The method used to enforce the sale of Busy Bee discs was to give the talking machines distributed by the O'Neill James Company a metal lug on the turntable, which would fall in the space between the label and the end of the playing surface. Therefore, only records having a supplemental hole to accommodate this protrusion could be played. Cleverly, by giving Busy Bee discs a normal quarter-inch spindle orientation, the records became doubly viable, since they could always be played on any Victor or Columbia machine. Busy Bee discs had an extremely colorful label, featuring a beehive with its occupants emanating from the center hole of the record. They were made from the masters of a number of different companies, including American, Star, Leeds and Catlin, and Zonophone. They appeared in 7-inch single-sided and 10-inch single and double-sided issues. There was even a rather unusual series of 10.5-inch single-sided discs pressed from American Record Company matrices. It should also be noted that at least on one occasion, O'Neill James is known to have produced a recording of its own. Upon a visit of politician and famed rhetorician William Jennings Bryan to Chicago, the famous man's words were recorded live as he addressed a crowd and issued on a special Busy Bee disc. Busy Bee cylinders were housed in one of the most colorful boxes used in the domestic market. The striking motif was rivaled only by certain European brands. All Busy Bee cylinder machines were fitted with a very slightly enlarged mandrel, which made it impossible to properly seat Edison or Columbia cylinders on it. Only Busy Bee records with their enlarged bore could be conveniently played. Although Columbia manufactured all of their cylinders for them, O'Neill James did sometimes arrange for separate recording sessions in which the performances were announced Busy Bee record. In other cases, however, the recordings were regular Columbia selections molded in the Busy Bee style. It is likely that the O'Neill James Company laid in a great stock of Busy Bee records in the hope that business would warrant it. From the evidence extant, however, it seems that this was not the case. After the independent record companies, Columbia aside, from which it purchased its inventory, had been driven out of business by their larger cohorts, O'Neill James continued to distribute badly out-of-date discs with the machines they were still having manufactured under their moniker. As early as 1909, the company had taken to listing other items as their principal source of revenue. And, though they were to survive until 1914, before being superseded by the Arthur J. O'Neill Company, their disposition turned to the liquidation of existing stock. There was another reason, too, for the change in activity of the O'Neill James Company. The talking machine interest had shifted late in the first decade of the century to a related firm, the Aretino Company. Arthur J. O'Neill had been granted a patent, number 874985, on December 31st, 1907. Explicit in this patent was the very nature of his unique disposition toward the talking machine. It is likely that O'Neill held high hopes for his future involvement in the realms of recorded sound. 6 months earlier, he had formed a new enterprise with all the anxious anticipation of a visionary demonstrating his chef d'oeuvre. On June 3rd, 1907, he had started the Aretino Company, Incorporated. It may shed some light on the personality of O'Neill to recall that Aretino was the name of a Renaissance Italian satirist and pornographer. Surely there is implicit humor in this choice, especially since others likely would be drawn to such banalities as Apex, Acme, Deluxe, even Victor or Columbia. The specifics of O'Neill's patent relate to a ring-shaped disc record, one with a hole so large it would go beyond what had been so far attempted by the Standard Harmony United Group. By producing a record with the greatest of all center holes, there can be no doubt that O'Neill intended it to be playable on any talking machine, even those of his great northern competitors, through the use of adapter rings. With this in mind, he designed Aretino discs with a center hole of 3 inches in diameter and equipped his machines to match. With his dream of the universal record at hand, it is understandable why O'Neill shifted the talking machine emphasis away from the O'Neill James Company. The two firms underwent a kind of consolidation after 1910. Following that date, even though it lost its identity as a separate firm, Aretino continued to operate with the greater prominence of the two. Aretino discs can be roughly divided into two series, with the probability of a few variations. The series with catalog numbers prefixed by A were pressed from single-sided 10-inch Leeds Catlin matrices. The catalog prefix D denotes double-sided 10-inch Columbia and occasionally Leeds and Catlin masters. Unique to the Chicago brands, a 12-inch single-sided series was drawn from Columbia. Aretino discs and new hornless graphophones were still being vigorously promoted in 1913. The next year, however, this commerce was interrupted at the same time as the demise of the O'Neill James Company. If any activity continued under the succeeding Arthur J. O'Neill Company, it must have been limited. There were other Chicago brands of talking machine and record which plied the fringes of the Midwestern market during the same period. They seemed to exist in vague association with the larger of the firms, even if there were no formal ties. This is especially evident in the case of the Diamond Record Company and the Consolidated Talking Machine Company, Incorporated, both of which sold odd-sized hole records designed for use on the Standard Harmony United type machines. Consolidated is interesting in that it was formed in January of 1916 out of the remains of an earlier talking machine venture. Listed in the incorporation papers is a figure of $6,800 for talking machines, records, accessories, and office fixtures. Unfortunately, the source of this inventory is not known. It could be that Consolidated had already been operating for a time without benefit of incorporation, or it could indicate the final destination of the Harmony and United stock, which is presumed to have been sacrificed 3 years earlier when Great Northern finally became the Standard Talking Machine Company. It should also be mentioned that as the second decade of the century began, and the identities of the companies within the two major business groups began to blur and meld, certain anomaly records appeared. For this reason, it is possible to find a certain Chicago brand disc with the wrong sized hole, such as a United record with the hole the size of a Harmony, or a standard disc designed to fit a United machine. Though never widespread, this practice is sufficient to give pause to anyone who thinks he's finally mastered the system. When I traveled to Chicago in 1976, I was determined to locate the actual edifices in which the business of the Chicago companies had been conducted. Starting out on my first day, I went straight to the streets named on the records and machines and began to search for the proper numbers. Wandering about the city, flushed with enthusiasm, I discovered only disappointment upon disappointment. The Dearborn Street address of Standard Harmony United, I found, was now a parking lot. I was shocked and dismayed to see that the Monroe Street address of Standard was occupied by a contemporary high-rise apartment building. Fifth Avenue, which had been the home of Great Northern and O'Neill James, was now a long string of dilapidated buildings in a poor section of the city. After traversing its entire length, finally ending up in neighboring Cicero, I was still unable to match up the right addresses. Each time it seemed I was approaching a discovery, the numbers would change capriciously and completely bypass the address for which I was looking. After my second fruitless day, with a notebook empty of notes and a camera empty of pictures, I was ready to conclude that no trace of the original buildings remained. It was as if some great vengeance had been wreaked against them to the last one. They had been the victims of urban planning, I supposed. This, of course, was true, but not in the way that I thought. My first inkling that something was amiss with my investigation came when a library employee told me that Wells Street, right in the heart of the downtown business district, had formerly been known as Fifth Avenue. The modern street of that name, which I had so studiously combed, was naturally the wrong one. This was my big break, I thought. Surely Wells Street would have at least one of my buildings left intact. Excitedly, I made my way to that thoroughfare, only to meet with the same frustrating inability to make the numbers match. As I slouched back to my hotel, I did not realize that it was an understanding far more important than any I had theretofore grasped, which would provide the key. It had made its way into my brain, however, that there was a little something funny about the addresses that I was encountering. The designations north, south, east, and west had been added to the addresses where none had been mentioned on the old machines and records. I began to research this mystery at the Chicago Public Library, and it was then that my foolishness and haste became evident. On June 22, 1908, the Chicago City Council voted a completely new system of building numbering to be in force and effect as of September 1, 1909. Had this original plan been left unrevised, it would not have altered the addresses of the talking machine companies. Purposely, buildings in the business-rife downtown section were not to be included. More's the pity. On June 20th, 1910, the ordinance was amended to include the whole city. It was then that the streets in the downtown area were divided into north-south or east-west segments, depending on their geographical orientation. Effective April 1st, 1911, all existing addresses became obsolete. So here was the rub. As far as I knew, all the original buildings still could have been standing, but the trick was to pinpoint them. Fortunately for posterity, The Chicago City Directory, during the years of the changeover, had printed a complicated chart to aid in the understanding of the befuddling procedure. By use of this information, I was able to speculate the actual locations by counting north, south, east, or west, whichever was most convenient, from the corners of the streets as... Fortunately for posterity, the Chicago City Directory, during the years of the changeover, had printed a complicated chart to aid in the understanding of the befuddling procedure. By use of this information, I was able to speculate the actual locations by counting north, south, east, or west, whichever was most convenient, from the corners of the streets as they intersected. In this way, I was able to find the buildings within the block if I knew the original numbers of the buildings on the corners. Amid this maze, I searched for some clue to indicate my reasoning was sound. This came with the Monroe Street address of the Standard Talking Machine Company. Any of you who have looked at a Standard machine or record may recognize the address as 200 or sometimes 198-202 Monroe Street. The high-rise structure, which I had surmised had replaced Standard, was actually at 200 West Monroe Street. Its huge 200 painted on the front had tricked me into looking no further. Yet, by using my counting technique, I theorized that the real building must be located at 205 West Monroe Street. Arriving back on the scene, I ignored the deceptively numbered high-rise and headed straight across the street. There I found 205 West Monroe Street, standing as it had in the days of the talking machine companies. This building, however, had no trace of its former occupants. It was just an old office building. I longed for a sign that I was correct in my assumption. There seemed little hope of this, however, since Standard had moved to Dearborn Street in 1911 and could have occupied the Monroe Street address for only a few months after the renumbering went into effect. I had no hope of finding confirmation. Yet, I was given it, quite by chance, as I examined a copy of the 1911 Chicago Central Business Office Building Directory, which I had not previously consulted because its information was limited to a listing of addresses. In it, however, the Standard Talking Machine Company was listed at 205 West Monroe Street, immediately prior to their evacuation of those premises. This Chicagoan saga is by no means finished. It remains a vital and ongoing subject, and it will continue until every flake of evidence has been brought to light. Come, show me another city with lifted head singing, so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning, flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job. Here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little soft cities, Chicago.
Okay. Maybe we have the curtain. I feel like I'm on The Price is Right here. Okay. Okay, and the first slide, please. Okay, this is obviously a standard disc record. Now, that's a dark green label. There were a number of variations on this. I'm showing this particular one because it's a paste over, and it, although I haven't checked, is probably pasted over a Columbia label, a black and silver, or the gold and black later ones. Occasionally, they were pasted over other labels, I should mention, such as D&R, which was another Chicago brand, which I didn't mention. But you can see around the corners down on the left side of the label where it's beginning to peel. Now, the name of the selection here is put on with a rubber stamp, and this was often done, suggesting that they were just getting the stuff at random in many cases. And, you know, if they ran out of their regular In the Shade of the Old Apple Tree on their indigenous brand, you know, with their own press label, they just stuck this one over and stamped it. And there you see the 200 Monroe Street address. Now, I don't show a Harmony disc, but they did use a similar label. Now, the indigenous label, that is, that which was used at the plant when the record was pressed and given a standard label, was black and silver, very similar to Columbia. And the same is true of Harmony. They also had a label such as this, which said Harmony Disc Record, as well as their black and silver label. And there are a few other things, a few other variations, especially of the pasted over kind.
I had one with diamond design that says standard.
Well, that could, it could be something with them. You know, an amalgam with a diamond record company, because they use that diamond symbol right with a hole in the middle.
Yeah, right.
Well, then there's got to be a connection there. Okay. Here's a United record. This is their, I believe, their indigenous label. That is the one that they used when it was pressed with this thing. They did have, again, like a black and white label, which was a paste over. And you can see the, you know, the enormous size of the hole there, as well as the address listed at the top as 608 South Dearborn, which was really the corner of Dearborn and Harrison Streets, which was the Heisen building, where the other ones were too. Okay. Here's a busy bee. Now, there were a couple of variations on the busy bee label, a couple of variations on the hole, the supplemental hole, which you see illustrated there. Sometimes the label at the bottom was cut obliquely so that it wouldn't be possible to recognize in a picture such as this the supplemental hole. I did not choose that for obvious reasons, but sometimes the supplemental hole is square cornered, and sometimes it's oval, such as this. And once again, you know, a great variety of masters were used, and often, I should say, or not often, but frequently, it didn't matter to them where they were getting the master from, as long as it was the right selection. So you could get a copy of the Liberty Bell March without the Liberty Bell, or you could get it with the Liberty Bell, depending on who made the record. They also used this sort of ambiguity amberized, which I guess they must have picked up from, or maybe Edison picked it up from them, I'm not sure. Somebody stole it, one of them did. There's a Busy Bee cylinder, and it's, as you can see, very colorful. Basically, the caps suggest its origins. Columbia, same color, same caps. As far as I know, I haven't found a Busy Bee label, cylinder label, pasted over a Columbia box, although this was fairly common in Europe. A number of brands did that. And the records themselves are sometimes marked Busy Bee, or sometimes marked O'Neill James Company, and sometimes have a title on them, and, you know, stamped on them, and sometimes just a number. It varies a great deal. There's an Aretino record with its extraordinary orifice. Aretino usually didn't list any kind of street address. I assume because, for obvious reasons, right? I assume that they sort of didn't exist anymore after 1910, and they had only recently been formed, really. But they were sort of brought into the O'Neill James Company, but became its primary functioning arm. So I guess they perhaps had a premonition about that. They were prescient and decided not to put an address on it. Sometimes they do have, I've seen them with a patent stuff on them, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they have something attached to the back, or sometimes, very occasionally, on the record. They're just, it's, you know, just the usual stuff that was used. Okay. Here is really the place where it all began. This is the standard disc talking machine. It's really nothing more than a Columbia AU, but they were calling it an AA. And this is the machine that Standard began to promote with its schemes around 1905. And you can see it's a very simple machine and extremely cheap. They did become a bit more ambitious later on, but insofar as the very premise of flinging a very cheap talking machine at someone to get him, you know, entranced by the records, you know, this is the one to do it with. Let me see. This is a machine which came along a bit later, in between the one I just showed, the open works, and this. There was a kind of a combination of the two, where they took the little horn, little japanned horn, off the open works, and they put it onto that case and called it a Type X. Now, this is the X2, which was slightly later, and around 1909, I believe, they began making these, although that seems frightfully late for a front mount machine. They tried to dress it up a bit to compete with some of the fancier machines that were around, and it has an X2. You can actually see the X2 at the front by the pivot, at the front of the tone arm, because that tone arm was a bit longer on the X2. And really, the motor inside is nothing more than an AU motor, a standard open works motor, mounted in an extraordinarily deceptive cabinet with a 10-inch turntable. So that was an interesting device. Usually they have blue horns. Occasionally they were issued with other horns, red. Would they play a I think originally probably did, but then again, Standard wasn't issuing any 12-inch, so, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a pretty flimsy, inside is a pretty flimsy mechanism, but you should get through about two records, I think, but usually the springs are weak now. Okay, here is a Standard Model A. Now, this has got to be the, you know, archetypical Standard. It's the one that's most frequently seen. This particular style was also being sold around 1909. I would think, I guess, that the Standard X2 might have been a bit earlier, a couple years or a year before this machine. But around 1909 to 1911, this machine was being sold, and they were sold in great numbers. And so Standard was really quite successful at what they did. You see a lot of them. Now, the reason you can tell that this is an earlier machine is because not only does it have the early address on it, the 200 Monroe Street address, but also it's got the short box, a low box. In 1911, they switched. When they moved to Dearborn and Harrison, they switched. And out of expediency,
They began making the Model A with a very much enlarged box. I mean, hugely enlarged. And they actually reduced the size of the motor and enlarged the box, which, you know, is great marketing. It's been used, I think, several other times. And anyway, by increasing the size of the box, they could make out of the same machine an internal horn standard or an external horn standard. And so they made the Model A or the Model B, the B being the internal horn machine, and by having increased the size of the box, they could fit an internal horn, a small internal horn, into it. So this is the early style. Now, it has the lacquered Japan translucent kind of finish horn, although they were sold to a large extent with just flat enameled horns, well, painted. It's a regular Columbia. You can see it's a Columbia. And underneath this particular one, and underneath a number of others, can be found a stamp indicating that it was made in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and by an anonymous donor. But okay, now here's a harmony. Now you can see it's the same basic thing. Once again, it's a Columbia. This has a lacquer or a flat, you know, opaque red horn. It's got the regular Columbia, you know, push pull on off thing. It's got the aluminum tone arm. It dates from around the same time as the standard Model A. Now it's interesting to note that this same cabinet was an incredibly enduring thing. It was being used as late as 1918, or probably 1920, by the Royal Talking Machine Company, which was another Chicago firm, which did not issue. Well, it made odd-sized spindle machines, but it didn't really issue records, as far as I know. But I did not mention it. But they weren't incorporated until 1918. And yet it seems that this would be old hat by then, but yet this very same machine with its sculptured pillars was being promoted as at that late date. Here's an internal horn machine, and a lot of them did make them. As far as I know, O'Neill James did not, because Aretino got the emphasis in the beginning of the teens, so they didn't really get to make any. But this is a symphony, a United, and you can see, although this is not a very good picture, the large spindle in the middle. It's basically, again, a Columbia, quite a bit similar to ones that Columbia produced under its own name. And this gives you an idea of what they did to the box on the Standard Talking Machine Company in 1911 in order to make it big enough to accept that horn that's in there. Now, it's a very shallow horn, and it gives very poor performance, but they had to make it big enough, and then that's what they did. Now, the standard Model B looks very similar, and there's a Harmony Model 12, which looks like this, and then there's the Aretino hornless graphophone that I mentioned. I think in one of their brochures they said that they expected to distribute 100,000 of these fantastic new machines in the year 1913. Now, I seriously doubt that, but, you know, there may be 100,000 of them somewhere in a basement in Des Moines, you know, all in one place. Okay, here's an Aretino back mount, again, the same Harmony kind of style, and a back-mounted Busy Bee machine was produced that's similar. It's called the Yankee Prince. These were usually sold with green horns. Aretino machines usually had green horns, standard Model A's usually had red horns. But you can see that there's a very large turntable spindle there. And they also used a larger, O'Neill James and Aretino used a slightly larger reproducer, which is not too evident here, but you can see that it, the end of the tone arm is not the same size as the reproducer, whereas it usually is on Columbias or standard Model A's. It's a little bit different, you know, nothing much. There's also some evidence that they used a removable, adaptable spindle. It was O'Neill's dream to provide machines with adapter rings to straighten out the mess that had been created by his competitors. And there's some evidence to suggest that maybe he did have an adaptable Aretino that he sold, although I'm not going to make any definite statements on that. Okay, here's a Busy Bee key wind, which is, you know, nothing more than a cue with a Busy Bee decal. And they were also sold in great numbers, or distributed in great numbers, whichever, and show up fairly frequently. A very ready-made machine for the kind of promotions that they were using. Here is a Busy Bee front mount. Now, this is a fairly early example of one because it's got a very dark case, which is a lower case than they later used. And it has an aluminum diaphragm, which is a Mobley thing, which got Mobley into some trouble. But it has that funny front-mounted horn. Now, you can see here that there's a deviation from the Columbia mold, that this really is not a Columbia machine. Now, if it was being produced, I'm not sure, but if it were being produced by Columbia, they were doing it in a way that they never themselves followed. And this is also true of the motor. It isn't just a regular Columbia motor thrown in there. It's mounted on the bottom of the case. It doesn't hang from the top of the case. And you can see the controls out the back are entirely different. Now, this was true of Aretino and O'Neill James. They did get some very odd-looking instruments. And even some of the Aretinos, the back-mounted and Aretinos and the back-mounted Yankee Princes were of some odd make. I'm not quite sure where they were getting the stuff. Okay, here in a very dark picture is a Yankee Prince, a back-mounted Yankee Prince, but this is the Columbia, a non-Columbia style. You just get a hint of the extraordinary label, which was one of the most striking used by any talking machine company that I can think of. And it's an allegory, really. You've got a Yankee on the right, stalwart, steady, tried, true, steadfast. And you've got a prince, you know, sodden and decadent, you know, sort of on the, you know, an old world kind of type on the with a cigar, smoking a cigar. On the left. Right. So, will Fred Williams please leave the room? But
he can stay.
But and then there's this bucolic scene in the middle of harvesting, which is, you know, sort of reaffirming traditional, you know, values of motherhood in the home and that sort of thing. It's a beautiful label. I like it, even though I appear to be not very serious about it. The other thing is a Queen Busy Bee, which is a BK, if any of you can see it well enough to see it. It's a Columbia BK with a Busy Bee mandrel and the information taken off the reproducer, so you don't know it was made by Columbia. It doesn't have the little label that BKs had on their bed plate, and it has a Queen Busy Bee decal applied to the front. So it was altered in a bit, but it really is just a Columbia BK, and was the, you know, sort of Cadillac of the Busy Bee cylinder machines used to reproduce the best sound, although by far more of the Open Works machines were sold. And that's it. I don't know where we stand. We're running late? Thank you.
It's a very interesting presentation. I'll have to ask people who are have questions, perhaps, for Mr. Fabrizio to perhaps address them to him individually, since we're